This audio recording is protected under U.S. copyright laws. It is produced by Nichols Patrick CPE and provided by your state society of CPAs for your personal non-commercial use. Further reproduction, distribution, or commercial use of this recording without written permission from Nichols Patrick is prohibited. Requests for permission to reproduce this material should be addressed to Nichols Patrick CPE, Suite A, 973 West Liberty Street, Hubbard, Ohio, 44425. Welcome to the weekly tax update. Weekly tax update for June 17th, 2013. We have 10 items that caught our attention this week, one of which is not even a tax item. It has to do with a spat between NASBA and the AICPA. But let's start with an internal legal memorandum in which the IRS rules that a collaboration between two corporations is a partnership. The corporations cannot elect out of subchapter K. And then a reaffirmation in an electronic communication out of the Chief Counsel's office that the IRS cannot levy on a taxpayer's principal residence without the order of a U.S. District Court judge. Then, three exemption rulings that we thought were interesting. In the first, a website service provider that facilitates the exchange of services for charitable contributions was denied exempt status because it was simply a profit-making undertaking for the website service provider. Next, an organization primarily operated to support those engaged in plural marriages, polygamy, has a substantial purpose of the support of an illegal activity, and they can't be exempt. And then a veterans organization that made very much of the fact that if you were a veterans post, and this is either the Veterans of Foreign Wars or the American Legion, one of the two, in any event, they really kind of went down the wrong path. They were telling all of their organizations that they could file for exempt status, stay open all kinds of hours, be open to the public as long as they had at least 10 members who were veterans. And what was happening is that private bar owners were seeking exempt status and setting themselves up as bogus VFW or whatever other posts. In any event, that group has lost its tax-exempt status. Those were 501c19s. And then we want to talk just briefly about the dust-up between NASBA and the AICPA on the financial reporting framework for small and medium-sized entities. That's not a tax matter, but it is very important to those of us who serve privately held businesses because it offers a way to avoid the onerous weight of U.S. GAAP. Then a case in which a taxpayer tried to avoid the effect of abandonment of a residence and foreclosure when she had not occupied the residence long enough to qualify for the Section 121 exclusion, a dentist who tried to deduct the mileage from his home to his office in another state and living expenses while he was there, a partner in Pricewaterhouse Consulting, which was sold to IBM back in 2002, who failed to properly report the receipt of payment or receipt of a note for unrealized receivables. You can't report the unrealized receivables on the installment basis. Those are not capital assets. It's a good thing to remember. We'll talk some more about that. And then finally, the IRS has, in response to getting its butt kicked in court several times over the past couple of years, has provided new guidance to its attorneys on how to handle equitable innocent spouse relief cases and reaffirmed that the tax court can, in fact, review those cases from the beginning as new and consider additional evidence which the IRS did not see during its administrative process. Well, let's begin with the Internal Legal Memorandum 2013-23015, in which the IRS reminds, and this is Internal Legal Memorandum, so this is giving advice to somebody that's out there in the field, the IRS reminds that Section 761A does in fact allow an election of all the members of an unincorporated organization to be excluded from subchapter K if it is availed of for the joint production, extraction, or use of property, but not for the purpose of selling services or property produced or extracted. So in this case, we have two corporations who are actively producing and selling a product who try to elect out of subchapter K. And in this internal legal memorandum, the IRS says you cannot do that. You are a partnership, not eligible to opt out, and if the product was produced in whole or in significant part within the United States, the collaborative entities must determine each corporation's allocable partnership items in order to claim a Section 199 qualified domestic production deduction. Next, an electronic communication 2013-23-018 as numbered by tax analysts. Very brief, in case you did not get the voice message, parentheses, belts and suspenders. They really don't want somebody to do the wrong thing here. This is an internal communication at the IRS. The consensus is that the service should seek judicial approval as provided in Section 6334 of the Code, which protects the principal residence of a taxpayer from levy. And if you want to discuss this, call us, but meanwhile, don't levy on the taxpayer's residence, right? Next, a letter ruling 2013-23-037 denying a website service provider exempt status. Anyone could create an account on the website and offer goods or services. Persons who bought the goods or services would make a payment to the website, but the payments would be directed to a charity. So the website was going to facilitate, for example, if I wanted to do tax returns, but not be paid for doing it, but rather have you pay my favorite charity, this website would facilitate that. The example provided by the website described an individual posting an offer to wash a car in exchange for donation of X dollars to a charity. An individual agrees to give the dollars to the charity, gives the dollars to the charity, gets the car washed. The IRS says that's a commercial enterprise. That is equivalent to a commercial undertaking. You're simply facilitating these transactions for a fee. You're not a 501c3 organization yourself. As to the organization supporting polygamy, for whatever noble purpose the folks who believe in that may think they have, a 501c3 organization cannot get exempt status for conducting, supporting, and condoning an illegal activity. Add to that, it was very clear in the application that the folks who support polygamy intended to seek the removal or appropriate alteration of laws specifically targeting polygamists, the ultimate removal of a state's constitutional prohibition against polygamy, and the site contained position papers on current and proposed laws, so the site was, they were going to be actively engaged in lobbying, and probably would have lost the exemption for operational defects, even if they did not get it for organizational defects. So you got to remember, if you're going to be an exempt organization, you got to pass two tests. You got to pass the organizational test, and you got to actually operate in an exempt fashion. You got to pass the operational test. Next, that letter ruling 2013-23-039, in which veterans group lose their tax exempt status. That's a 27-page ruling. I wonder why. Well, if I worked for the Internal Revenue Service and I were going to issue a ruling telling either the VFW or the American Legion that you were going to lose your tax-exempt status for many of your posts or your whatever those organizations are that are scattered around because you are running open bars and what we told you on the website when you sought exempt status turns out not to be true. You can't take advantage of the law in a commercial way while you're operating as an exempt organization, no matter how high you fly the flag. I would make sure that I was very thorough, and that's what the IRS did here. Our next item is that dust-up between NASBA and the AICPA that I mentioned. After the AICPA really lost patience with the Financial Accounting Standards Board back last June, when they, after decades of stalling, they finally appointed a private company counsel with no rulemaking authority, which was not the recommendation of the Blue Ribbon Panel that had taken 2 years to make their recommendations. The AICPA developed and issued its own comprehensive standards for financial reporting by privately held businesses. It's referred to as the FRF, Financial Reporting Framework for SMEs. The reason it's important to us tax folks is that it is a combination of income tax basis and traditional accounting concepts. It does not involve such esoteric GAAP applications as accounting for impairment or projecting the present value of future cash flows that relate to a lease, or any of the other, what some of us have come to call, mumbo-jumbo that accompanies current full U.S. GAAP. In my opinion, the National Association of State Boards of Accountancy does not have a dog in this hunt, and the reason they don't is that their purpose is to protect the public that relies on financial statements the public that relies on financial statements is investing in public companies, the stock and the debt of companies that go to the public debt markets. And the AICPA made very clear in the preamble to the FRF for SMEs that it is for the private company, and these financial statements are intended to inform management and creditors give them useful information about the financial position of the company. So in my opinion, it is inappropriate for NASBA to throw sand in the gears when the AICPA is simply trying to do something that we have needed for at least three decades in my personal experience. And the last decade, the Financial Accounting Standards Board has made promise after promise, and nothing has been done. So we're left with an unworkable situation for our privately held clients that need and want some sort of comprehensive financial statement reporting. Income tax basis is not the right answer. Cash basis is not exactly the right answer. And so rather than each individual CPA creating her or his own hybrid method, it makes sense that we would have a sanctioned system from our professional association. And in my opinion, NASBA's resistance in this circumstance is inappropriate. By the way, you'll hear it at the end, but these opinions are my own. We can't tar and feather the sponsor with my opinions. Next, Drusilla Malonzo abandoned her home in California at a time when it was underwater. She purchased a residence in Sacramento in 2005, lived there until sometime in 2006 when she moved to San Francisco. For some portion of 2007, she rented out the residence, reported the income from the rental, and claimed $12,000 in depreciation. Later in 2007, she was unable to rent the residence, and so she abandoned it back to the lender. Now, in California, the mortgage on a personal residence is non-recourse. So the abandonment of the property to foreclosure, the sale price of that home is going to be the remaining balance on this non-recourse debt, which was $325,855. The taxpayer had paid $333,000 for it, took $12,000 of depreciation, so her basis was $321,000, and she had about almost $5,000 of gain, which she did not report. And the reason I put this in this week's program is I want to make sure everybody understands that a foreclosure is a sale. And if the debt on the property is without recourse, the sale price of the property is the non-recourse debt. If the debt on the property is with recourse, the sale price of the property is its fair market value at the time of foreclosure, and then the taxpayer has to deal with income from debt forgiveness. The foreclosure will be reported on a 1099-A. The debt forgiveness will be reported on a 1099-C. Next, we have Javad Begdeli, a dentist who lived in Pennsylvania but had a dental practice in New York. The good doctor claimed $31,000 in 2008 and $24,000 in 2009 for the expenses of operating his automobile, driving back and forth to his office in another state, and he claimed a deduction for $5,000 of travel expenses. About $3,800 of travel expenses in each year for those times when he would stay at a hotel and not drive back home. The problem here is his work location was where his practice was. He chose to live somewhere else. You cannot deduct the expenses of traveling from the place you choose to live to your tax home. The good dentist's tax home was where his practice was. So the IRS disallowed all those automobile expenses, and the dentist came up owing about $26,000 in tax and about $5,000 in penalties. Lori Mingo, TC Memo 2013-149, was a partner in PwC Consulting. PwC Consulting was acquired by IBM in 2002, and Lori got a note for her partnership interest, an installment note for her partnership interest for $832,090. In the assets that she sold were included $126,240 of unrealized receivables. That was her share as a partner. Now, that should those unrealized receivables should have been reported as ordinary income in the year of sale, and they would have provided basis in that note. As it turns out, Ms. Mingo and her husband exchanged the note for shares of IBM stock under fairly favorable terms that had been negotiated when the original acquisition was made, and they had a significant long-term capital gain. But they had a problem in that they had not reported $124,000 of income back in 2002. And so in this court decision, TC Memo 2013-149, the court works out with the IRS and the taxpayers exactly what the taxpayers should have reported and how they should have handled the basis from that reporting from their 2002 return. Interesting. See, 2002, 2007. Wonder how the statute of limitations plays out here. It never comes up. Neither the taxpayers nor the court nor the IRS mentioned it, so I presume that they had settled the issue of the statute before they ever got to court. Finally, we have a Chief Counsel Advisory 2013-011, which is issued to clear up confusion and avoid unnecessary administrative and court appeals from spouses requesting equitable relief from joint and several liability on a jointly filed return, typically with someone who used to be their spouse. Cases cited in this memorandum to IRS attorneys are those in which it received clear instruction on how it should be evaluating claims for innocent spouse relief. One of the leading cases would be Porter, 132 TC number 203 back in 2009. Another is Corson, C-O-R-S-O-N, 114 TC 354 in 2000. Thanks for joining me again. Look forward to seeing you again next week. Meanwhile, stay safe.